Hello, and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Studio team.
I'm Romain Guy from the Android Toolkit team.
I'm Chad Haas from Android Developer Relations.
And I'm Chris Craik from the Android Architecture Components team.
You may have heard Chris from such podcasts as Android Developers Backstage.
And I'm Dustin, same thing as Chris, but we're on the same team together.
But first time on podcast.
So but first time on podcast,
like,
yeah.
Totally different.
And hopefully the last time. Oh, wait.
What? We'll see how this goes.
Let's just get through this.
So welcome again to the podcast. We're going to talk about performance today. Specifically, we're going to talk about benchmarking, which relates, I guess, I was thinking we were going to go in two directions today. One is there's a new benchmarking library out there for Android X. Mm-hmm. We'll obviously talk about that, but I think more talk about the fundamentals of benchmarking codes, the problems that you face, the things that you need to do about it, and hopefully the things that the library solves.
Yeah, absolutely.
So why don't we start at the beginning? Why is benchmarking difficult?
So what is benchmarking?
Let's start very early there. What is benchmarking?
All right, fine.
In the context of our library, benchmarking is I have this piece of code. I want to know how fast it is. Most importantly, I want to know how my changes to the code improve or make it worse. And so typically what you can do with, like, say, a UI experience on Android where you're scrolling or something along those lines, you navigate through your app, you maybe take some profiling information, some tracing information, and you capture that, you look at that after the fact, and that tells you how fast the thing was. But that's a very long loop to have to go through every time that you want to make maybe a very small change. So benchmarking in this context is taking a very small loop of code, like a well-defined loop of code that just is run in a loop, measured, stabilized, we'll get to that stuff later, and get a single number from that.
So is that in your scenario of, you know, fling through the recycled review?
Mm-hmm.
I assume that you're not going to be benchmarking an actual set of scroll events. You're going to say, hey, the slow thing is probably, you know, the layout of a list item, so I'm going to benchmark that. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess we kind of dive here into a lot of the details, but like for recycler view, what a lot of our recommended approach for benchmarking recycler view is actually to send it a fake scroll. It's to just say recycler view scroll by the height of one item. And what you do is every single loop, you tell it create one more item, find one more item, and it does go through all the cycles of, you know, that item's life cycle, similar to if you were actually creating scrolls, but you're not actually visibly scrolling. You're not producing frames, and that's one of the, you know, core ideas here, is that,
scrolling by one item will do both binding existing items and creating the new item. So you're testing both code paths.
So scrolling by the height of one item does all of the new work for showing a new item from the bottom of the list. So all the previous items will stay bound, but say this new item will have to go through attach, layout, bind, potentially create and inflate, all of that sort of stuff, and you can measure all of those, and you also have like control over exactly which of those cycles happen, depending on how integrated your test is. But this is kind of a more advanced and specific sample. I think like an easier sample might be, I have this one callback that processes some data, and it happens on the UI thread, but let me see how fast I can make it. That kind of thing. Something that you said, say, captured in a trace was taking a long time. Let me try and iterate on it and improve it.
Yeah, I think our general recommendation is to try and find like some well-defined piece of code that you know like you want to optimize. Whereas versus like a whole UI UI thing might be.
So it's typically a single block of code that'll run on a single thread. You're not
talking about
a core native set of things.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that specific point about a single thread is particularly important, because if you have just a block of code running on a single thread, you can very easily get away from a lot of things that might add noise. The kernel scheduler, you can make the job of the kernel in terms of setting the device's frequency much simpler, and it's just got a continuous amount of work. It can just go up to whatever frequency that it wants to get to. And I guess that kind of leads into like the stabilization part of benchmarking, which is like the main goal that we've had in benchmarking is making it as easy as possible to get very stable numbers and accurate and release accurate numbers out of Android. And that's not always obvious what you need to do in order to configure your code to run as close to release and as stably as possible. So
there's like cold start and warm start,
yes.
Right? And
there are a lot of things I'm sure Chris will go into more details, but you already mentioned like, you know, the frequency of the CPU. There could be thermal throttling, obviously. Yes.
I was more thinking from a user perspective now that often when we benchmark, you know, in the tools, like, hey, you run it like five times to warm things up and then you measure, right?
Yes.
But it does mean that you are basically getting the benefit of code that runs a lot. Yes. Whereas if some code is just going to run once, maybe that cold start is important. The fact that you're the only client of some libraries, you're loading tons of new code, is actually a problem that you shouldn't just hide.
So in Benchmark, what we do right now is we specifically measure only hot code. And like that is documented. We will always do those warm-up phases. We've heard a lot of people are very interested in measuring startup, and that is important for exactly the reason that you say, is that like one of the easiest ways to make your average case faster is to add a cache. And that's a really good way to hide all of your initialization cost from all of your benchmarks as well. So, you know, it's something to keep in mind, absolutely.
Okay. All right, now Chet's question. Why is benchmarking hard?
No. So, well, okay, we will get there, but we have thrown around some terms that maybe we should explain. So what do we mean by CPU frequency? Like, what is that thing and why is it a problem in benchmarking, right?
So CPU is like the brain in your phone.
It's the central processing unit.
So the CPU in a mobile device is designed first and foremost to save power, and in bursts do a significant amount of work, but it will reduce its frequency. You know, if you hear 1 gigahertz, 2 gigahertz, that's the frequency very often of the CPU that will vary from anywhere like to, you know, 10% of its maximum value when the device is very idle and doesn't have a lot of work to do, all the way up to maximum clocks, say 2 gigahertz or whatnot, when it is significantly under load. And so the CPU makes those decisions based upon all sorts of information that it has. There are hints passed in from like the input system that says the user's scrolling. You probably want to be at a very high frequency right now. And you know, if there's not a lot of work for the CPU to do, though, it'll clock back down. Now, this is generally a very useful approach for saving power while the user is using the device and like, you know, interacting with it intermittently. But it is very bad for benchmarking stability, because if you just happen to be touching your finger to the device, you know, while you're profiling versus after a few seconds of fling, maybe that same amount of work will be lengthened because the CPU is going slower, because your entire device is slowed down.
And the frequency changes are not just about workload. I mean, you did mention briefly that, you know, the CPU takes a lot of information to choose the frequency, and thermal, so how hot the CPU gets, is also one of them. So it's not just power.
Yes.
It's also but the ability to dissipate.
And there's different types of CPUs on some devices as well. I think the 5X had two different cores, like large core and small core.
Yes. Most devices these days have.
Okay. Yeah, they have what's called a big little core configuration. Mm-hmm. And it really depends on the SoC and the phone, but the difference between the big and the little cores can be pretty dramatic. It's not just about the frequency sometimes. It's about do they have in-order execution or out-of-order execution. So depending on which core you run on, and depending on your workload, you might get very different results.
Yeah, there are a lot of different configuration options that can affect the performance.
If you want to understand some of the dynamics that Chris is talking about in terms of throttling, run Systrace. So Systrace command line tool, well, it's in the Android Studio, but you can't see the multiple process aspect of it in the IDE. So instead, run from the command line and check out the output. There's docs on the on the website about this. And you can see if you measure frequency is one of the options you can pass in. I don't know if it does it by default, and you can actually see this thing
throttled by default time. Yeah.
So fling a list and actually see what we're talking about, where, you know, frequency goes up and then it goes back down, and you can imagine what that does to benchmark numbers and benchmark consistency.
Yeah. So before we go too much further into like what the library does, I think it might be useful to just kind of explain at a high level what the API is, so that people who aren't familiar with benchmarking kind of understand a bit more of what we're talking about. So the benchmark library is actually an augment on top of the Android X test infrastructure. It is it allows you to write benchmarks that are basically just standard JUnit tests that just happen to have an extra rule attached to them. And that rule is responsible for giving you a handle to measure something in a loop, and then it'll handle outputting that data for you. So fundamentally, these are instrumentation tests. They get stuck into a Android test directory just like you're used to. They have to be in a separate module for reasons that we'll talk about later, that just for isolation and performance guarantees. But that's kind of the API service that we're talking about here. It's you know, probably the library with maybe the smallest API surface compared to implementation, I would say, in all of Android X, because it really is just a couple of methods to measure this loop.
Now, so you said that it measures. Does it mean that the test never fails? Like, is there a way to say, I don't want you to pass this test if things have gotten more than 10% slower?
Well, so there are ways to fail the test. It is a JUnit test. But generally what we use failure for is an assumption that I wrote this benchmark with has been invalidated. So for example, say I write a benchmark that is supposed to be measuring like text layout or something, and then I check some, you know, internal metrics thing and I said, oh, wait, actually this benchmark didn't do any text layout at all. I can fail that particular benchmark. But talking about like whether a benchmark failed because of a regression, because it's gotten worse, is actually something that we do at a higher level, at the level of continuous integration outside of the benchmarking library entirely.
Well, that makes sense, because I was thinking, like, if I were to check in a test, those numbers would probably be device-specific.
Yes. So those numbers are device-specific. They're configuration-specific. They're also, like, OS version of your device-specific, because, you know, you might get an updated version of ART that significantly improves performance.
If I want to use your benchmarking library to make sure that on my CI server, across 15 devices or AVDs or whatever,
yes,
that performance doesn't get worse. At least not within noise.
Yeah, so
how do I do that?
Yeah, so this is something that I think is, it's really easy to write a system that gives you a kind of a decent approximation of when a regression happens, but has a lot of like manual intervention. Because like correctness tests fundamentally scale really well to be running in CI. You can run them on different devices, all great. If you have failures, those you can highlight those, and it's really obvious what those are. In the context of benchmarks, you have to worry exactly as you're talking about. You have to say, well, each device and variant that I run on, those have to be completely isolated sets of data. I don't want to ever consider that there's a regression between build A on device, you know, 1 versus build B on device 2, because that just doesn't make sense.
Right, and I need to record this data and from test to test. So there needs to be something on top of it, right?
Yes. So the benchmark library outputs a JSON file with data about the measurements that it's made, with the intent that your CI infrastructure, whatever you use, you can slurp that data up and start making those decisions at a higher level about whether a regression happened. So I can tell you about the strategy that we use inside of Android X for alerting regressions. And this is actually based upon infrastructure provided by the Skia team. You might be familiar with that from the last time I was on the podcast about the team that does a lot of graphics rendering infrastructure for Android and Chrome and so on. They also have a lot of investment in this area of regression testing because they test on many, many, many variants of devices all at once. And so what this infrastructure does is basically continuously run every single version of your build. You run benchmarks and you measure the performance. And so then what it looks for is it looks for regressions by looking at a window of builds. And so instead of saying build A versus B, oh, B got worse because it's lower, the idea is accounting for the fact that very often when you have mobile devices or, you know, configurations that you don't perfectly control that aren't super stable, you'll get variation. And so if you get variance from one benchmark run to another, you can't really trust the fact that A and B is worse than A, meaning that there's a regression from B to A. So instead, what we do is we look at a window around any particular build. So we look at for example, we look at the 5 builds before, the 5 builds after a particular CL, build, and we say, does this look like a step function up or does this look like a step function down?
So as long as you degrade performance really slowly over time, then you can sneak by the CI.
Well, absolutely. I mean,
yeah. Okay.
So we had something similar to that because we of course have performance benchmarks for many things, including the Gradle plugin.
True.
And we were noticing that, you know, back in June or something, the builds were getting significantly slower and we couldn't figure out why. Mm-hmm. And it turned out it was the infrastructure itself that had gotten slower. And so what we do now is we have a baseline build, which is, you know, we never change. It's always the same version. And if that goes up too, well, we know it's infrastructure. It's not that we made something worse. And so, you know, when they diverge, we broke something worse. If the baseline also moves, okay, well.
So baselines are really nice if you have like a small set of inputs that you want to say, these are the standards that I never want to change. But if you want to keep adding new benchmarks, like for instance, the Android X project right now has a few hundred benchmarks. And we don't want to have to maintain baselines for each one of them and, you know, bless and say, oh, this is a okay build. We intentionally regressed or we intentionally performed, update the baseline. Instead, we just look at those deltas up and down.
Yeah, well, we tend to graph many things on this, in the same graph, right?
Yes.
So there's different colors for different benchmarks running, and the baseline is one of them. And so we just, when they're all sort of, when something happened to all the benchmarks, we can see, well, was this a regression in the code that caused all of them to get worse, or is it the infrastructure? And that's what the baseline's for. So we don't have a baseline for each. It's just a baseline that is sort of like, this is measuring something about the machine.
Oh, I see. So a baseline for the machine itself.
Yes.
Oh, okay. I see. I got you.
We never change the bits. We just run the same thing over and over and over. And so it gives us a pulse of,
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Yeah. So typically what we do is we will often like have devices flashed completely from scratch in between each build. And that does a lot of resetting in terms of things that the OS might be doing in that would give you instability from build to build. Another thing that we do is we just generally avoid things that touch storage because storage is relatively difficult to benchmark because of how unstable performance is.
And it degrades over time.
Yeah, things
as well.
That build systems tend to need to store what they're doing. So,
yes, absolutely. you might consider a RAM disk or something.
So you mentioned the library, the benchmark library, has a fairly small surface, APS surface. Mm-hmm. So it's nice because it integrates into JUnit, it does some measurement, and it outputs a JSON. But why wouldn't I do this myself by just writing a loop that calls, system.nanotime?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, what does benchmark do that is valuable? Because it goes well beyond that, right?
Yes. Yeah. So benchmark looks so benchmarks, I would say, has a few high level features that it brings to the table beyond sort of the naive, I'm just going to write a loop and call nanotime. First and foremost, it looks for incorrect build configuration, things that are going to affect your performance and make it not look like release performance. These are things like if you're running with application debuggable true, so that application tag in your manifest, what that does is that basically tells the runtime, hey, make whatever performance compromises you need, but just make sure that the debugger works really well. And that's great if you want to hook up the debugger at any point in time, but it massively affects performance in sort of unpredictable ways. So it's something that we explicitly ban in benchmarks. There are also other configurations that we look for. We look for, like, do you have code coverage on? If so, we don't want to let you do that because that's going to change all of the code that you're running. We look for
low battery. That was one, right? Like, even if you're plugged in, your clocks will still dive. So it's kind of like a pretty surprising thing, right? Like, oh, I'm plugged in, so I should be charging, so I should be able to just use my clocks at full speed, right? Like, nope, like, doesn't matter.
Do you look at the type of build on the device, if it's a user build, user debug?
Yeah, so we verify that it's not an Eng build, and this doesn't usually matter for app developers, but for framework developers, if you have an Eng build, those are kind of similar to debuggable. Those are builds meant to allow you to iterate quickly while you are developing the platform itself. But they, again, massively change performance characteristics of the device. And so we just don't let you benchmark on those builds.
So that is the benchmark library does prevention. It looks at the current configuration and makes sure that you're doing the right thing. Yes. So what else does it do?
So one of the other things that it does is handling clock stability in the best way that it can per device. So first and foremost, what you'd really like is you'd like to be able to say, I want all of the clocks of the device to be exactly stable. I only want one set of cores to be active, say the big cores or the small cores, kind of doesn't matter, and just only run with these clocks. Don't let the CPU frequency affect my benchmark results. And you sort of can do that, but only if you have a rooted device, which is not the vast majority of developers, right? So we do actually support this use case. If you do have a rooted device, we have a Gradle plugin that provides a simple command, Gradle W lock clocks. And what that'll do is that'll look at your device, latch its clocks to something that it thinks is sustainable, and prevent them from changing so that you can get stable numbers from that device.
When you're talking about a device here, you're talking about a real device, right?
Yes.
Because an emulator, I assume that even if I have a rooted emulator, trying to set the clocks.
Yeah, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And in fact, we actually ban running on an emulator entirely because we don't trust the performance characteristics of an emulator to carry over to performance on a real user's device.
Well, especially because then you're measuring the underlying computer, which we have even less control over.
Hopefully you're measuring the underlying computer, but even then, it's got like massively different performance characteristics, right? Sure. The CPU is massively faster. The memory characteristics are completely different. And certainly the storage is going to be significantly different. So,
and do you look at things like, thermals? Do we have ways of looking at, is the device running hot? Can we sustain the current
clocks?
What
we do right now is we lock. So starting with locking clocks, what we do is we lock them to 50%. And I've never seen a device locked to 50% ever hit thermal problems.
What if the AC is down in my CI room?
I want to go back to that point. That was an interesting thing that I heard a while ago, where locking clocks, you would think, well, I'm benchmarking. I should obviously, see if we're running well at the best, at the best frequency, in the best situation. But actually, that doesn't matter. Consistency trumps all, right?
Yes.
It really doesn't matter what speed you're running at, as long as it's reproducible.
Yeah, so. Actually, I think what's important to note here is that in some cases you may, but most of the time what you care about is not the absolute numbers when you're benchmarking. Yep. It's deviation from known numbers.
It is looking, is my build A faster or slower than build
B? Am I going up or down?
And in particular, if you lock at a fast speed, eventually you're going to hit a thermal problem and it's just not going to work. But if you lock at a slow speed, then hopefully, as Chris said, thermal is not an issue and you can just always have that consistency.
Interestingly, one way we worked around this kind of problems when we were benchmarking filament was to not look at time at all. And it's very specific to some optimizations, but we look at the number of instructions executed by the CPU.
Yeah, that's a good way to get stable numbers. It is very, you have to be very careful about how you use it, because the moment that you say touch disk or anything like that, then
There's that, and also like some instructions can take longer than others.
Yes, so
like
also true.
Yeah, you have to understand what you're doing, but there
are other. It is a really, like, if you have purely CPU infrastructure that you're testing, then it is a really nice way to say, did anything change in this code path? Yes, it did or not. Now, I did talk about locking clocks, but that doesn't solve the problem for very many people, right? Like, that's how many people have a root device? Not very many. So the next step that we actually have, we have like sort of this tiered system of approaches that we try to apply. So if we can lock clocks, great. In fact, if you are running on a rooted device and you don't lock your clocks, again, benchmarking will fail. It'll say, no, you need to lock your clocks. Give us that stability. If not, though, there's actually this feature added a couple of platform revisions ago called sustained performance mode, which was, I think,
so the
actually
VR mode.
Yes. So it's designed for it was designed for VR, basically to give a guarantee that, you know, you can have a sustained frame rate continuously over time. But
and for very similar reasons, because VR, your performance would change based on how much the device heats up, and that's bad because it would make you, you know, puke basically if it changes, like, as you're moving your head around.
Yeah. So if you're if you're at 40 frames a second going continuously, and then suddenly it drops to 5. Exactly. Feels terrible.
Is this like the boarding pass mode? You know, when you use an airline app and you say short boarding pass, some of them will just like, it feels like it just enters this other mode, right? Where the screen gets super bright.
And, oh, it keeps the screen on?
Yeah, but it's not just that, because I mean, video players do that. But there's like, I've noticed several apps that do this, it's similar
like
to running the VR mode.
Well, so the VR mode specifically is for things that are doing continuous work. Hopefully in those boarding pass situations, you don't have to like say, make any performance guarantees, because it's just displaying a single window the whole time. So this mode, though, isn't actually available on all devices. As I said, it was added a few Android releases ago, but again, not on all devices. But what it is it's a flag on activity. Now, it's really designed for VR, but we did not let that stop us. So what we do, in fact, is if you have a headless benchmark, something that's just benchmarking code, we actually inject an activity launch ahead of your benchmark so that we can set the flag on that activity and guarantee stable performance.
Oh, and one last bit about this flag. Before you run off and add it to your application, it does not mean that you're going to get the best performance possible on that device.
Quite the opposite.
It's about sustaining that performance.
Yes. So generally what it does, and so I can get into the grossness of this, but what it does, of how we use it specifically, but what it does is if you have a multi-threaded process, it says, okay, no core can go above 50%. And that's actually a pretty good way to avoid thermal throttling problems. However, if it's a single-threaded process, it will actually let you go up to full clocks, depending on the device, depending on the situation. However, for benchmark, we didn't want to make any guarantee. We didn't want to make any constraints on exactly what the user could do. And what the user could benchmark. We didn't want to say, like, have the sustained performance mode think that we are switching modes between different runs or, like, different individual benchmarks, because that can mess all sorts of things up. So what we do in the benchmark library is we actually trick the system into thinking we're multi-threaded by being continuously multi-threaded. We spin up a thread.
It doesn't
at
sound
the very
like much
beginning.
Of a trick, then.
I have seen that technique used in apps a long time ago on Android. We're just running a thread doing busy work, which was not real work, they would keep the device.
Yeah. So during benchmarks, if you were on a sustained performance device and you don't have lock clocks and so on and so forth, and in those constraints, we will spin up a background thread, do absolutely nothing continuously. But don't worry, we set it at low priority, so everything's great.
And I imagine you set a core affinity on the thread?
I don't think that we do right now, okay. But we totally could. That's a good point.
I mean, I think everyone expects that when you measure something, you affect it.
Yes.
That's like one of those core uncertainty principle or something like that.
Wait, so I'm having a little hard time here. Is it a fact that all devices out there have multi-cores now?
It is almost a fact.
Oh, okay, so
Basically, the only device, like the most recent devices, I think that don't have multi-core that I'm aware of are like some Wear devices from a few years ago.
Okay, I was just wondering, like, if somebody runs this particular technique on a device with only one core, then it's going to completely mess
So hopefully the fact that we are setting incredibly low priority on that core will mean that it will completely yield continuously to the other thread because they're both fully loaded.
I see.
You know, that's the idea. And then finally, if you don't have sustained performance, we do the final approach, which is we look for thermal throttling. So what we do is we run the benchmarks continuously. What that means is that probably you're going to be running at max clocks. And then in between each benchmark, we inject our own little tiny micro benchmark. And what that does is that just looks and sees, has performance regressed since the last time that I ran a benchmark? If it does, we sleep. We just make the device go to sleep for, you know, 90 seconds or something along those lines in order to let it cool down and then continue the benchmark suite. And it's surprisingly...
Do you use the microphone to listen for the fan, perhaps? There's just no fans on phone.
I mean, it sounds crazy, but it does work, though.
Yeah, it's surprisingly effective. Yeah, so if you saw our I.O. talk, there was a graph showing, you know, one particular device just spiking from, you know, say, one... spiking from, you know, 1x speed to, like, 5x speed and just ping-ponging back and forth continuously. And this technique just entirely avoids that problem. Even though it does make the device, the entire process slower, but, you know, stability is really the number one goal there.
Why did you not name the library instead of benchmarking? You could have called it a series of clever performance hacks.
You know, I think that there was some tool that fell apart when we used a name that long, but...
Okay, all right.
This is a trick that Roman can use in meetings too, because usually his fan is like full blast whenever I'm next to him. You can actually suspend your build for a few minutes.
Roman?
Let the fan.
No, that's because I'm building code. I'm compiling.
Yeah. It's actually just his breathing. I don't know if you've noticed that.
If we can update the build system to sleep 90 seconds every time it hears the fan, that would be kind of a nice advantage.
All right.
So this is the part of the meeting when I start talking about my feature requests.
Yeah, go for it.
Awesome. So coming back to this original thing, right, where I'm sort of trying to figure out if an improvement is an improvement or not.
Yes.
Right? I'm trying to figure out how I would use this. And it seems like a nice way that your library could support this was if I could write my code where I have two code paths switched by some sort of property.
Yes.
And I can tell you, hey, I've set up this environment variable or this system property or whatever it is to control one or more versions. Can you now run through all of them and tell me which one's best?
Yes. So actually, The feature that we use for this is just JUnit parameterized tests. If you use a parameterized test and use that particular flag that you're toggling to go through like four different variants of your particular whatever, you know, code that you're going through, then you can just switch those dynamically, get output in Studio, and so the output pops up in the bottom right pane.
So I add some parameters. I use that in my code, and then I run the test, and it'll spit out numbers for each, and then I just look to see which one's
smallest. Yes, I mean it's very similar to like a correctness test with a parameterized correctness test, where you know you get like a red icon or a green icon for each one of them. It's just now you also get numbers for each one of them in the bottom right panel now.
That is cool.
So we talked about all the configuration stuff and the clever performance hacks trademark, but what do you actually do? What is the API for actually like setting up and running that? Well, we talked about setup, I guess, but running the test. What?
So running the test, I mean, it is really fundamentally a JUnit test. You right-click it, you run it, you run your, you know, connected check through Gradle. All of that stuff works as standard. If you're asking about like the specific Java and Kotlin APIs.
Yeah, what are developers supposed to do to actually put code inside of their project run a test?
If you right click over on the left pane on Studio, there is actually a wizard to help you add a module, right? Like, so you can say add a library module, add an app module. There's also one for benchmark module now in 3.5. So if you do that, that's a great first step to get benchmarking into your app or into your library project, and that'll give you a sample benchmark that you can just start putting code into, declaring dependencies just like you would any regular library.
Some code in there that's like run with or whatever, and then you pass a lambda that is the thing you want to measure.
Yes.
Is that how it works?
Right, yeah. Yes.
Nice.
On the benchmark rule, there's like a measure repeated function you can call, and you pass it a block, and you just run whatever code you want to measure in there.
Yeah, and...
So you don't write the benchmark loop yourself, right?
No. Well, we basically give you a construct to do that. So this is actually one particular case. Like, so our library is full Kotlin, and one of the reasons is so that we can use inline functions to get rid of a little tiny bit of overhead here and there that we wouldn't want. So in Kotlin, you have a run with, and you pass that a inline lambda. In Java, though, the API looks sort of similar, which is, you know, you just, we pass you a function that you call to get a Boolean, you stick that in a while loop, and there you go.
Which actually, that overhead is actually kind of important, though, because it lets you, like, measure smaller things, right?
Yeah, it does, yes.
I'm still trying to figure out, like, where they get to, okay, so they're you know, deep in the bowels of their code, they want to see what changes in this area are
Yeah, so think of it very much similar to if you were writing a correctness test for the balance of your code, right? Like, hopefully your code is modular enough that you can say, you know, I'm trying to benchmark foo component. I'm gonna instantiate a foo component, fill it with some fake data, run some operations on it, right? Like, yeah. That's how you'd run a correctness test. Exact same thing for a benchmark. You have those exact same entry points, and you stick it in a loop, measure it that way.
Okay, and let me get more specific then. So yeah. Startup has traditionally been a really hard thing to test.
Yes. Okay. And it is something that we do not support right now.
Okay, so that was one of the questions.
Listen.
Did he? I missed that
You should
part.
Listen to this episode, chat, when it airs.
Okay, so it's not a general approach for testing everything. It is an approach for testing specific loops within your code.
Yes, for hot code, things that run many times. Things like, you know, new items showing up in your recycler view, database queries that you care a whole lot about, things that happen, you know, not necessarily during the startup of your app, but everywhere else.
So you need to make whatever you want to test public, right? So you need to extract it into a method that you can call from.
Yeah,
from
I mean
a
it's
test
yeah exactly, but I mean that's internal or so along.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
And so back to the actual benchmarking itself and the loop. Does the library do anything to hopefully guarantee that I'm going to be jitted or that I'm not?
Yeah. So what we found in practice is that we have a warm-up procedure where what we do is we run the benchmark for 250 milliseconds, and then we keep running it until it stabilizes. And so we have, like, some, you know, running moving averages, look for them to converge, that kind of thing, like, really simple. But in practice, this works really well for allowing time for both the CPU to ramp up if you're running on a device without locked clocks, or for JIT to finish and stabilize. Because, like, as JIT keeps going and as the loop keeps getting faster, we will just keep deferring and keep warming up.
All right. So the results, sorry.
Go ahead.
So results... So you run your test, and then what?
And so then it spits out data in a number of ways. So it spits out data into the Android Studio log in the bottom right. You'll see, like, method name, number of, you know, nanoseconds or whatever. And that's one way that you can look at the data. But it'll also spit it out in JSON when you run from the command line. And, you know, there are docs online of how to get that set up and how to, like, wire that up when you're running in, say, CI, for example.
Okay. And speaking of CI, so how do people integrate this into their lives? I guess since it's JUnit, like, they know how to do this anyway.
Yes, and that's actually, like, the main reason that we tried to reuse everything that already exists from Android testing infrastructure is these are just JUnit tests. You know how to use JUnit tests. Like, if you want to use activities, use an activity test rule. Like, all of the infrastructure that's existed for correctness testing, we wanted to leverage for benchmarks because we really wanted all of that stuff to just keep working and keep being simple.
All right, so speaking of CI, so you are running this right now, right?
Yes.
So you have a dashboard of results.
Yes. So the Android X team has a dashboard of results, and I think that, like, we'll probably do a blog post at some point relatively soon about, you know, how all of that stuff works.
More specifically, it's a public dashboard now.
Yes. It is a public dashboard. AndroidX-perf.skia.org.
So if you want to see, you know, some of the results that come out of this thing, you can go check out the dashboard and then.
But the primary link that I would tell people to look at is d.android.com/benchmark. That tells all the documentation for the library, how to use it, and then also how to get it running in CI, how to use how to use it with third-party build systems if you need to do that, all of that sort of stuff.
Okay. And the state of the library is what now?
So we are in alpha, hopefully going to beta very soon.
It was alpha at I/O, right?
Yeah, so it was alpha 01 at I/O, and yeah, we're hopefully going to beta.
And
very
what are the changes that have been happening during alpha? Like, what surprised you when people started using it?
So originally when we launched at I/O, we actually didn't fail when you did any of those configuration issues that I mentioned before. We would just kind of spit out a warning.
Yeah.
And I think we learned more and more that people ignore warnings. Warning, W error should absolutely be the default, and it is now. So now instead of, you know, the library saying, here's a result for running with a debuggable build, but you sure shouldn't look at it. Now instead of doing that, we just crash. We don't even run your benchmark.
Okay.
That was one of the big ones. We've done a lot better integration with Gradle, worked around a lot of issues with, like, external storage on queue. I'm trying to think.
Tell Chet more about Gradle.
Sorry, gotta go.
I mean, what do you want to know? What do you mean, like?
Just extra changes, that, other things that we've changed since I/O. I mean, a lot of the core ideas of the library have just been stable since I/O. And in fact, like this is actually a pretty long-lived library. So this has been around, I would say, for about 4 or 5 years internally as part of the Android platform. So the UI toolkit team originally started wanting to add some benchmarks for various bits of UI, but found that it was very difficult trying to use existing benchmarking infrastructure. And one of our core constraints there is we want to test actual Android UIs. I want to actually pop up an activity and measure performing operations on that activity. And so the natural approach there is to just use JUnit, use what exists there, use, you know, Android test rule. And so that lived internally for a while. It was used by a lot of the text and graphics folks to optimize a lot of bits of the internal guts of the Vue system. And then at a certain point, you know, as we've got the Android X project growing larger and larger, we realized, you know, this is really something that we should make public and that we should really, you know, let Android X developers as well leverage for their benchmarking needs.
Cool. I would ask what's next, but we don't generally talk about those things. And in fact, you said, well, aiming at beta sometime.
Well, we can
soon.
At least talk about some of the things that the library doesn't do, right? Like, so you measure
startup.
Time,
that's what I heard.
But do you measure anything else, like instruction per cycle, number of cycles?
No, we don't have any other metrics right now. We are kind of punting that temporarily for now. That's probably going to be 1.1. Yeah.
And you mentioned that, you know, this library was used by the graphics folks to. Including you,
yes.
To measure improvements and optimizations. Can you explain in more detail why you would use something like this as opposed to, you know, the typical metric that is frames per second?
Yeah. So we actually originally started off on the platform when we were building some of our continuous testing and benchmarking infrastructure, writing actual full system benchmarks that would actually scroll a list, look at frames per second, all of that. You end up hitting a lot of issues with frames per second, not only because frames per second has drawbacks in like how you can't tell the difference between a frame that finishes in 5 milliseconds versus 14 milliseconds. Now, you know, on maybe on a fast device, you maybe don't care all that much, but running on a slow, like if your user is running on a slow device, that difference makes a huge difference. And then additionally, you don't really understand the distinction between 59 and 60 frames per second, because if you miss VSync and you drop a frame, that's catastrophic visually, but you just don't see that when, you know, your number changed by a tiny percentage. And so for a lot of those reasons, we switched off of using frames per second. In fact, for those benchmarks, we started using frame time and a histogram or, you know, 99th percentile kind of thing for frame timing, because that would tell us a lot more about exactly how bad the bad frames were. Like, fundamentally, we don't nearly care as much about optimizing the fast frames as we do about making the bad frames go away so that, you know, you get a much smoother UI. And so we started moving in that direction. I'm gonna
pause you right there.
Sure.
Remember where you're going, because Tor and Lama have way more important things to do than sit here.
And so I want to stress that Chet is not invited to those important things that we have to do.
I want to stress that I got meetings enough, so have fun with that. We're gonna take a picture and
we're doing a selfie.
All right.
Okay. So you can look at all of the frame timings in this histogram sort of way and look at, like, how bad is my bad frame? But the problem there then is, even though you've used a better metric to look at how your device's UI is performing, you're really building in a lot of noise that comes from other system components that aren't what you're trying to measure. So in the case that I'm trying to measure, how fast is this, you know, the frame in which a recycler view item shows up on screen for this particular big app, then I don't really care about all those slow frames. In fact, because I'm trying to look at an approximation of that number by, let's say, looking at like the 99th percentile of frame time, I actually get like a really awkward picture where I have to run for a really long time to make a lot of those events happen. And I get a lot of noise as well. Noise from, you know, scheduler decisions, from the fact that, you know, VSync operations may happen in one way or another that's outside of my control in the graphics pipeline. If I really just care specifically about how slow is my recycler view, then I can just benchmark my recycler view. And that's where I think this core idea came from of, you know, giving people the JUnit way to simply run some UI operation and just measure it directly. Because while measuring frame time is definitely a good thing to do, while you're actually iterating and optimizing, you really want something that's much more stable. And that's much more representative of the one thing that you're trying to optimize.
And would you recommend that people try to boil down their like inner block of code that they're benchmarking as small as possible? Or like, cause there is that trade-off where ideally, you know, they boil it down to this really tiny place and then they can see exactly what's going on. On the other hand, the timings are going to be less meaningful the smaller they are, I think. And the jitter is going to be more less manageable and larger. And B, it's a bigger problem. Like you kind of want, well, yeah, here's a big block of code.
If you break it into 500 problems, then now you have 500 problems, right?
Yes, and 500 tests are awesome, but maybe not awesome to, you know, write and maintain, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So what I would suggest is that like once you start, the first place that you should always start for benchmarking is
tracing
with performance problems. You know, like that's where you have to actually start benchmarking. Because if you just say, I wonder if this code is slow, let me write a benchmark, then if it's not, you've wasted your time. It's a lot easier to just put like a trace section around that and look at that performance information in SysTrace, or even just run the profiler in Studio and say, what about this is taking surprisingly long?
Figure out what you want to benchmark first and then benchmark it.
Okay, and how do you figure that out?
So you look for large sections of the trace that you think are surprising to you. And I literally mean like personally surprising to you, like, wow, it really takes a long time to do, you know, Operation FUBAR. That really shouldn't take so long. Those are the kinds of things that are really good to you know, dig into with profiling. But if you want to iterate and measure quickly, that's what benchmarking is for.
And this is SysTrace. This is probably sampling version of
profiling,
CPU profiler.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Because yes, if you're looking at, the times on, if you're using the tracing version of the CPU profiler, you're going to get a funny result out of it.
Yes. Yeah. So generally method profiling is really useful for figuring out what the heck is going on, but it doesn't tell you when.
Yeah, the ordering of operations is really useful information, but the actual times are really skewed, especially when it's going, what I found when it's varying between code that's being run at the Java layer and code that executes at the native layer, like there's like vastly different overheads.
Yeah, and actually that kind of reminds me of some further inspiration for this infrastructure is that the original benchmarks that we wrote that were, you know, tight loop benchmarks that were just running synchronous code in a block, we're using the Google Benchmark infrastructure, which is C++ for the renderer. And this was incredibly helpful for applying a lot of operations to operations that happen frequently in Android rendering. So things like creating a paint operation, changing an attribute on a paint, recording canvas op, all of those sorts of things. The vast, vast majority of the complexity of that is in native. And by writing native benchmarks for those, we could get incredibly stable, accurate numbers that would allow us to, you know, say, remove an allocation and see the performance impact of that kind of thing.
Yep.
And it was, you know, jealousy of our C++ infrastructure that, you know, also drove a lot of this infrastructure in Java and now Kotlin.
Yep. So you mentioned tight loops. Did you talk about it earlier as part of the like the configuration or setup or just how you run these tests? Like, is it built into the benchmarking infrastructure to automatically spin this thing 10,000 times?
So a lot of benchmarking libraries will give you a method and say, I will run you however many times and spit out the result. We do it more like Google Benchmark does, which is we give you a block. We give you an operation to say, here is how you loop. So like, as Dustin was saying earlier, you access benchmark rule dot measured repeated open brace end brace, and anything in that brace is measured many times. And what that does is that gives you a really easy way to declare, you know, initialization ahead of time and you know, verification afterwards without having to like massively complicate your test cases with shared at before and at after annotated methods. So
you mentioned Google Benchmark. I don't know if you mentioned that before. I don't know what that is.
So Google Benchmark is a benchmarking infrastructure for C++ that's pretty popular. But just the important thing to know for the audience here is just that it has a very similar API that inspired a lot of our work here.
Is this a public thing or something
internal? Yeah. This is like GitHub/Google/ benchmark. Yes.
Cool. I just didn't happen to know it. All right. What did we forget to ask? Or we could just use this time to talk about Roman.
What are you working on, Chet? No.
It's never about me, Chris. Oh, okay. You've learned that. Anything? Your favorite thing about the library? Results that you've seen in the field?
I'm trying
or
to resist
internally?
Talking about like future plans.
That's a good thing to resist.
Because there's a lot of like hotly requested things.
Yeah.
I think we can go ahead and say that like,
memory profiling and startup benchmarking, like those are things that are like hotly requested and they're definitely on our mind. And we're working on them. but I'm not supposed to promise a time.
Yep.
So there it is.
Did you have you seen surprising or validating results as this thing came online and started
absolutely.
To be used?
So
in CI
one of the heaviest users of the infrastructure right now inside of Android X is the Compose team, and they have been adding a lot of benchmarks that measure, you know, sort of core assumptions and like core bits of their loops, which has been really informative of, you know, oh, the cost of, say, like the benefits of inlining a function and so on here and there. And in one of the core thing that I think is surprising is when you see that, you know, there is a tiny construct that you expect to be zero cost, but it's used literally everywhere, that making a tiny change to it can have a big performance improvement.
Yep. Cool. Nice to see that it works. great. All right. Well, people that aren't in the room, go check out this thing and stay tuned for beta hopefully soon. Mm. And people that are in the room, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.